Michelle Rayner joining you now. Today, the first in a four-part series called History Under Siege. The series offers a comparative reflection on debates and tensions over the past in a number of countries around the world, from Asia through Latin America and Europe to Australia's very own public stoushes in what's become known as the History or Culture Wars. Today, in the first program, we travel to one country where the past, both recent and distant, continues to shadow the present. Japan.
The war really has never ended for the so-called comfort women. We were called comfort women.
The Japanese has got this kind of self-image of the victims of war, and therefore their peace ideology is weak.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it.
From 0 point, the same complete leveling as ever. Cast a shadow over Hiroshima and over the land of the rising sun.
We have to teach the objective past, both dark side and sunny side.
This is what Japan has never done. They have never taken responsibility for their war crimes.
What is lacking here is the moral imagination, learning from this war experience, victimization, and extend their moral imagination to the people we victimize.
We are announced the guilty of the Emperor Hirohito, which was a big taboo in Japan.
I feel very much ashamed that the Japanese of my father's generation committed such an appalling crime against innocent young women.
My visit to Japan in 2007 to survey debates and tensions over history and memory coincided with the 70th anniversary of one of the most contested events in 20th century history, the Japanese invasion of the Chinese city of Nanjing, or Nanking, in 1937. This history has been a running sore between contemporary China and Japan, and Nanjing stands out now as emblematic of all of the sensitivities over the past which still exist between Japan and its Asian neighbours. Although Japanese historians had led the way in uncovering and documenting this early chapter of the nation's dark history, there still appears to be today a pervasive unwillingness, particularly at state level, to really acknowledge the truth of the Nanjing invasion in 1937. Indeed, inside Japan today, there's a group of defiant neo-nationalists who want to counter what they claim is Chinese exaggeration and willful fabrication over the history of Nanjing.
These scenes were photographed by an American missionary and smuggled out of China after the rape of Nanking. In one of the bloodiest massacres of recorded history, they murdered 40,000 men, women, children. Those who lived might better have died, for the horror of their twisted and torn bodies was worse than death.
That's from the 1944 film The Battle of China, made by celebrated American director Frank Capra. It portrayed the events of Nanjing, 1937, and was used to rouse anti-Japanese sentiment during the Second World War. And the recent 70th anniversary of Nanking, or Nanjing, has put debates about history very squarely back on the table. Nowhere was this more evident than in the spate of documentary and feature films about this history underway in several countries around the world. Even Oliver Stone was rumoured to have taken an interest in the Nanjing invasion, with a view to make a Hollywood epic out of it. But it was the domestic Japanese film interpretations of this history which had got most of the attention and raised the eyebrows of historians and scholars inside Japan and abroad. David McNeil is a journalist based in Japan, where he teaches at Sophia University in Tokyo. He's taken a close look at the documentaries being produced in Japan about this history for their take on what the Japanese themselves for a long time would only ever describe as the Nanjing incident.
The latest movie which has caused all the stink is a fairly small-scale documentary. It's only got a budget of $2 million. And it's directed by a man called Mizushima Satoru, who has a long history of sort of neo-nationalist support, neo-nationalist writings and so on. He writes for right-wing magazines in Japan. And the movie essentially argues that Nanking, what we know as the Nanking Massacre, was an entire fabrication, a fabrication by the Chinese side, by Chinese communists. And when I visited the set in December, they'd built a mock-up of the gallows on which seven of the leaders of the war, including Hideki Tojo, the prime minister, the prime minister during the War of Japan, they built a mock-up and they've dramatized the hangings of those men. And Mizushima said that while he was looking at those hangings, that he was actually in tears because he believes that these figures are comparable to Jesus Christ, and that's his words, not mine. He says that these people sort of saved Japan, sacrificed their lives for Japan, then saved it and were killed.
And according to David McNeil, Satoru's unapologetic version of Nanjing has a significant number of sympathizers in Japan.
If you go to the website of this movie, the Sakura Channel, which Mizushima-san owns, which has helped produce this movie, you'll see that there's a list of politicians, in some cases very senior politicians, who have expressed support for the work that Sakura Channel does and for the movie itself. One of them is Nakayama Nariaki, who is a former, first of all, he's a member of the ruling LDP, and he's also a former education minister. So that, to me, you know, is the interesting thing. It's the sort of support that comes to these projects in the shadows, if you like. Mm. And that is quite significant in Japan.
And were there any historians in that list of support?
Yes, there are. There's a group of quite well-known historians, neo-nationalist historians here. Their reputation, I have to say, I don't think I'm stepping into controversy here, but I think their reputation is quite low. One of them, Higashi Nakano, who is a professor of Asia University here, he has been sued by two of the survivors, successfully sued by two of the survivors of the Nanking Massacre, in Chinese and Japanese courts, and he refuses, in fact, to debate. I've tried to contact him many times, and he refuses to come out and discuss his work and debate his work, which for me is the key test. Fujioka is another historian, another very well-known historian, and he's been saying for years that Nanking is a fabrication.
So these two names that you mentioned would possibly fall into the group of historians described as the illusion school?
That's right, yeah. There's sort of three schools, if you like. There's the Maboroshiha, which is the illusion school, as you correctly say. These are people who, against all of the evidence and despite all the facts and the testimony of survivors and the testimony and of people who witnessed what happened, including Americans and British and Japanese and so on, they say that nobody or a very tiny number of people were illegally killed in Nanking. And then you have a group of people in the middle who sort of say, well, yes, people died, but certainly nothing along the lines of what the Chinese say. You know, the Chinese side argues essentially that 300,000 people were murdered in Nanking, and sometimes even the figure is 350,000. And then you have the so-called massacre school, which is the Gyakusatsu in Japanese, who say that, you know, essentially support the Chinese side. And there are people in Japan who would go along with that, you know, and there's some very famous journalists. In fact, the most famous journalist in relation to the Nanking Massacre is a guy called Honda Katsuichi, who is a Japanese man, who went and indeed was the first journalist outside of China to expose what happened there. And he went to China in the early 1970s and reported it in a series of very famous articles in the Asahi newspaper. And it is kind of, I guess, not that known outside of Japan that there are people, of course, here, especially in the academic community, in the artistic community, who despise the kind of revisionism that's going on now. But those three schools, if you like, would be where the debate falls at the moment.
How much do you think it's known or not known about by younger Japanese today in contemporary Japan?
You know, they will say, yes, I've heard about the Nanking incident, and they won't say Nanking Massacre, which is a key point in Japan, of course. And then they will say, but the Chinese side has exaggerated what's gone on. And there's this sort of fetishization of the figure of 300,000, and this goes across the media in Japan. There's no attempt really to get into the arguments about what happened anymore. And I've sort of noticed over the last 5 years in particular that many of my students, even students who've been educated abroad, would now argue, you know, the Chinese side has exaggerated. And from that step, it's not that far to say that the whole thing has been made up and that Japan did nothing wrong. And what's in the center of Tokyo? Well, that's the Yasukuni Museum, which is essentially a right-wing museum arguing that Japan had no choice but to go to war.
The war memorial in Tokyo, Yasukuni Shrine, has become the symbol of everything that's gone wrong in Japan's relationship with its neighbours. China and Korea say visits to the shrine by Junichiro Koizumi show Japan hasn't come to terms with its past, because as well as thousands of soldiers, the shrine is home to the spirits of convicted war criminals.
This is the soundtrack of a Japanese wartime film that screens for visitors to the Yasukuni Shrine Museum in downtown Tokyo. The Yasukuni Shrine and its accompanying museum is another simmering point of tension between Japan and its neighbouring countries. The shrine contains the remains of Japanese military officers, those who many Koreans, Chinese, and possibly even Australians would regard as war criminals, and that various Japanese prime ministers have, over the years, visited the shrine, has outraged these countries and brought international opprobrium upon the Japanese state. Well, given the odour that surrounds Yasukuni, it's not surprising to find that many historians and others inside Japan consider the shrine's war museum something of an embarrassment. And it's easy to see why, when the English language text panels in one room of the museum explain that the Japanese were forced to enter the Second World War after their country had been invaded by the Allied forces.
The military were given, the comfort women, like they were given a packet of cigarettes.
Jan Ruffo-Hearn, speaking on the BBC about her experience of being forced into sex slavery, one of the so-called comfort women, by the occupying Japanese forces in Java during the Second World War. And like the invasion of Nanjing, the comfort women issue continues to haunt Japan. Just last year, a bill was introduced into the US Congress which threatened to take Japan to the International War Crimes Tribunal if it didn't publicly acknowledge culpability over the forced sex slavery of women during World War II. Inside Japan, there appears to be an overwhelming silence in response to the comfort women issue. Professor Hayashi, I thought we could start by you telling me a little bit about your own interest in this aspect of Japanese history. But if you look hard enough in Japan, you can find those who oppose the government's entrenched whitewashing over the comfort women history. One of these is historian Hirofumi Hirashi, who's published a number of books exposing his country's use of sex slavery during the war. Professor Hirofumi teaches at Kanto Gakuen University in Yokohama.
As for the document records in Japan side is concerned, I think they did not have a sense to think this comfort woman issue was a serious crime. Those documents were not hidden. Of course, it took time and labor, but I eventually found them in Japan and also in America, UK and Australia.
In 1944, Japanese army truck arrived at the camp with high-ranking Japanese officers, and they told us that all the young girls from 17 years and up had to line up in the compound. And then a selection process started. They picked 10 of the prettiest girls. We were put on this truck like sheep for the slaughter and driven away to the city of Semarang. The truck then stopped in front of a large Dutch colonial house. When we entered the house, we were told by a high-ranking Japanese officer that we were in that house for the sexual pleasure of the Japanese military. So we found ourselves in a brothel. we sort of protested, of course, loudly that we were taken by force, that they had no right to keep us in this house, that it was against the Geneva Convention, and they said they could do with us what they liked. We were absolutely terrified. You know, we were a very innocent generation. We knew nothing about sex. We were all virgins, and then, of course, opening night arrived. And the memories of that first opening night of the brothel have tortured my mind all my life. And we were just systematically raped night and day by Japanese military.
How important have been, in terms of your research and your determination to see this history as a human rights issue, how important have been the testimonies of the surviving women who were incarcerated in these stations?
ですから1991年に初めて
In 1991, when Miss Kim Hak-soon disclosed that she has been a comfort woman, that was the first time we really got to know that what a sort of experience and hardship she had to go through, and those people got damaged mentally and physically, and it remains up to now.
Your most recent research has been the American involvement in this history. In the 40s, the post-war, and the 50s, in the occupation years, I think. Can you describe the American involvement?
Talking about U.S. Army, it is known that Japanese Internal Affairs Ministry made comfort station for the American soldiers. After the war and also occupation period, and so it was September of 1945 to the March of 1946, and it was called RAA, Rest and Amusement Association, and also we find a record that they closed it in March of 1946, but for this half a year, American soldiers used these facilities.
Because the Japanese government did wrong what they were doing, we want them to pay reparations for us and make their formal apology to us.
Korean women at the weekly Wednesday rally they've been holding outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul for over 15 years. Korean women made up 80% of those forced into sex slavery during the war, and the intransigence of the Japanese government over an apology and reparations is the source of a deep and lingering wound between the two countries. As well as this, Japan's occupation of Korea for most of the first half of the 20th century adds to this ongoing tension.
An apology coming from the government would sort of give us back our dignity. We have deserved that after 60 years. And it's no use apologizing if it's not followed by action. It's no use if you break a window to just say, I'm sorry, you have to pay for the window to be repaired.
In May 2007, the then Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, while in the United States, made a traditional Japanese deep bow of humility and expressed what appeared to be an apology on behalf of his country for the sorry story of the comfort women. But for some who've campaigned on behalf of the surviving women, Abe's gesture proved hollow. They say that it was cynical and opportunistic, that Abe's hand was forced as a result of Japan's complex economic and diplomatic relationship with the US. So, what did historians inside Japan make of Shinzo Abe's actions? Hirofumi Hirashi.
When Prime Minister Abe met a person from the Congress in America, he made an apology. He made a comment of apology with the word forced, the comfort woman was forced. it was clearly he made that. But however, in Japan, domestically, he never admitted that they were forced to do that. So he had this double standard.
Well, I don't think he's genuinely apologized, you know, because initially he said there was no enforcement on a woman who became a comfort woman. So he tried to somehow please Americans by changing his statement. By doing that, he's actually inviting more criticism because of his hypocritical attitude. You know, if we deny these war crimes that we committed, then we create more mistrust amongst the neighboring countries like Korea, China.
Yuki Tanaka, who's research professor at the Hiroshima Peace Institute. And not long before Shinzo Abe made his apology to the US Congress, a new museum devoted to the history of the comfort women quietly opened its doors in central Tokyo. It's called WAM, the Women's Active Museum for War and Peace, and it owes its genesis to the pioneering Japanese woman journalist and activist, the late Matsui Yayori. WAM doesn't receive any funding from the Japanese government and instead relies on membership and private donor sponsorship. And while it's currently comparatively modest in size, just several rooms inside the compound of a Christian university in Tokyo, WAM is certainly one museum in Japan that's unafraid to take a line on the still sensitive issue of the comfort women. Mina Watanabe is Secretary General and Curator at WAM.
We opened this museum in the 60th anniversary of the end of war. War memory issue was a big issue, but the Japanese media didn't cover at all about the opening of WAM, even though this comfort women issue and war memory issue is really big diplomatic and political issue. And it was really the time, the year 2000 afterwards, when Japan started denying again the facts of the comfort women issue too. So that was really the driving force to make the museum.
이름이 황금주. 온 세계를 다 다녔기 때문에 다.
25 days before the graduation of my fourth grade in elementary school, I was forced to join the comfort women because the Japanese government refused to provide me with food if I did not go.
In the entrance, we have now 155 survivors' faces, I mean portraits, as well as we also keep the movement's documents. There are many newsletters who has been supporting the trials of the survivors of comfort women. There are 10 lawsuits against Japanese government by the survivors. And after we started in the year 2005, every year so far, we are conducting a hotline to collect any information on comfort women issue. And first year, we received more than 80 calls from the veterans or witnesses or some grandson or granddaughter of former soldiers. But the situation in Japan becoming worse and worse. And as you see from our exhibition, that in the year 1997, all the junior high school textbook had some reference on comfort women's system, but from 2002, 2006, and they have been erasing, and now in the year 2006 textbook, they only have 2 out of 7, two textbook had reference on comfort women issue, but they don't have the word comfort women anymore. The reference is really getting much more subtle.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military
base. The first one was dropped on a Japanese city this morning.
We won the race of discovery against the Germans.
Hiroshima lay in ruins. Within a few seconds, the sizable city had been demolished by the atomic blast.
It was designed for a detonation equal to 20,000 tons of high explosives.
I realized the tragic significance of the atomic bomb.